is my great honor to nominate Richard Nixon for re-election as the next president of the United States.
On June 7th, 1973, a private detective in Miami, Florida, received a strange call. The private detective's name is Don Ross. And while Don is in Miami, the man on the other end of the phone is over 100 miles away in Okeechobee. As a private detective, Don has received hundreds of calls from prospective clients, from investigating an unfaithful spouse to gathering information on potential insurance fraud or helping locate a missing person. When you're in that kind of work, you do it all. But that call on June 7th was really odd. In a calm, quiet voice, the caller asked the private detective if he could place recording devices in every room in his house. And not only that, he wanted his home phone and office phone wiretapped. When the detective asked why, the Okeechobee man responded that he was in fear for his life. Detective Ross explained that he'd love to help, but says that wiretapping without a warrant is technically illegal, so he couldn't do that. Still, after hearing the concern in the man's voice, Don says they should set up a meeting where they could discuss options on what he could legally do for him. The two agree to meet in a few days and hang up the call. As he got off the phone, there was something about the call that stuck with him. It didn't sound like your average garden variety paranoia. It was something else. Something in the man's tone. What was he so afraid of? The caller had identified himself as Charles MacArthur. Don recognized that name. MacArthur was a wealthy businessman who owned one of the largest independent dairy farms in the world. Could he be worried about a potential business rival? MacArthur wasn't just a successful dairyman, though. He also had a budding career in politics. He was part of the prestigious White House Fellows Program in 1969. The program is known for launching the careers of senators, generals, and national power players. Through that program, MacArthur formed a personal friendship with President Richard Nixon. During his stint in the White House Fellows, MacArthur had his picture taken in front of the White House. He tells people afterwards he had his picture taken there because he plans to be back one day as president. MacArthur was in the early stages of planning to run for governor of Florida. And after that, he planned to run for the White House. And this wasn't just a fantasy or daydream. MacArthur had millions of dollars and powerful connections in the political world. As a private detective, Don couldn't help but run every scenario through his head. In any case, he was looking forward to finally meeting MacArthur in person and hearing exactly what he was so worried about. A few days later, on the morning of the scheduled meeting, the private detective arrives at his office, pours a cup of coffee, and sits down to read the newspaper. His eyes scan the paper until a headline catches his attention. As he begins to read it, his heart stops. There, printed in black and white, "Millionaire Charles MacArthur found shot dead in Okeechobee." Don was completely stunned. He had talked to MacArthur only days ago. The phone call had occurred on June 7th. Now, 3 days later, on June 10th, he was dead. Just days after telling Don that he feared for his life, Charles MacArthur was found shot dead in his own home. what had made him so afraid in his final days? What could make a man with so much money, power, and political connections scared enough that he'd want to tap his own phones? We look into the mysterious death of the most powerful man in Okeechobee in today's episode of True Oki. On the morning of June 10th, 911 operators received a call from Charles MacArthur's wife, Nadine. She and Charles had been together since they met in high school. And now, she was calling for help, because her husband had been shot in the head. She tells the 911 operator that Charles was alone in their bedroom when she heard a gunshot. First responders arrive to the scene and find Charles MacArthur in the bedroom, lying on his bed with a gunshot wound on his forehead. He was still in his pajamas and was covered with the top sheet of the bed from the waist down. His right arm laying on his abdomen, his left arm fully extended at an angle away from his body. The entrance wound on his forehead indicated the gun was fired at a very close range, only a few inches away. There is no gun on the bed or on the floor. So, this wasn't a suicide. Paramedics transport MacArthur to the Okeechobee General Hospital, where he's pronounced dead on arrival. He was only 36 years old. Although he'd go on to become the most powerful man in Okeechobee, Charles MacArthur originally wasn't even from the area. He was born and raised in Miami, the only son of a legendary dairy farmer, B.B. MacArthur. He went to high school at Miami Edison. And even in high school, there were early signs of the man he'd become. He was an overachiever. If there was an extracurricular, he was part of it. And not just part of it, he wanted to be the leader. He was the president of the YMCA High Y Club and active on the debate team. It was clear early on that he had a lot of ambition. Those years at Miami Edison would also turn out to be very important in MacArthur's life. And that's because he'd meet the love of his life there. While in Spanish class, he was introduced to a girl a grade below him, named Nadine Orr. The two began dating in high school, and continued dating as Charles went off to college at the University of Florida. Eventually, Charles and Nadine got married after 7 years of dating. But shortly after getting married, the pair had to uproot their entire life. Charles's father had decided it was time to pass the torch. So after years of working under him at the dairy, now, Charles was going to be stepping up and taking over MacArthur Dairies. So Charles and Nadine left their city life behind in Miami and moved to Okeechobee in 1963. To know exactly why they had to move to Okeechobee, you have to understand what was going on in the dairy industry in South Florida in those years. For decades, the dairy industry had been mainly in Dade and Broward County. But in the 1940s and 50s, dairy farms in South Florida found themselves being priced out of the land due to increased development. As more and more people came to Florida, property in places like Broward and Dade became more and more expensive. And that pushed the dairy farms in those counties inland to places like Okeechobee, where prices were much lower. The land was cheap, which made for a good deal for dairy farmers like MacArthur. But it was cheap for a reason, and that's because there was nothing there. At the time, there was only one stoplight in Okeechobee, and not much else. It had to be quite the culture shock for a couple that was used to going on dates at the Miami Opera. In Okeechobee, the only entertainment was watching a movie at the drive-in theater.
It's intermission time. The show starts in 10 minutes.
And even then, it might be interrupted by a herd of cows that escaped the pasture next door.
Get out and stretch a little and relax before the show begins again. And why not make it refreshment time, too?
But the couple made do. They adopted a daughter and raised her in Okeechobee. Nadine would host weekly dinner parties with a few other Okeechobee couples. They would dress up as characters from Gone with the Wind or Cleopatra. Nadine would try to get Charles to come out to the Okeechobee Country Club, but he'd usually want to leave early. There wasn't much to do in the area because the economy in Okeechobee was pretty stagnant. However, it didn't stay that way for long. In 1945, there was only one dairy in Okeechobee. But by 1976, that number had risen up to 26. Profits in the industry were also rising at that time. Milk sales amounted to only about $38,000 in 1960. But by 1970, they had risen to over $15 million. The Okeechobee News reported that in 1972, Okeechobee County was the leader in dairy production in the southeastern United States and accounted for nearly half of Florida's entire milk production. Charles MacArthur was a big part of that. As the money began to flow into the area, Okeechobee began to change and grow, with Charles taking a lead. MacArthur built the first apartments in Okeechobee, the Oak Lake Apartments. He paid his employees a good wage and set safety standards in his dairies that were decades ahead of his competitors. MacArthur became a stockholder in the Okeechobee County Bank, the director at the Florida State Chamber of Commerce, and he started the Charles MacArthur Foundation. He secured cable TV rights for Okeechobee and Miami in a company called Florida CATV. When one of his associates asked him what the big deal about cable rights were, MacArthur explained that he envisioned a future where you'd be able to order things and shop directly from your TV, thanks to cable. He was predicting the rise of cable TV, QVC, and eventually online shopping, decades before they happened. I mean, that's not bad for a dairy farmer. With that kind of vision, it wasn't surprising he was chosen to join the prestigious White House Fellows Program in 1969. It offers firsthand experience working at the highest levels of the federal government. As a part of the program, individuals spend a year working as a full-time, paid fellow to senior White House staff and other top-ranking government officials in Washington, D.C. On July 10th, 1969, a headline in the Okeechobee News announced that, quote, Okeechobee is losing its most prominent family. Over the next year, Charles accompanied Nixon White House officials and his class fellows on a whirlwind blur of overseas trips, government meetings, and seminars. He accompanied the administration on a diplomatic trip to the Middle East, including Iran, Kuwait, Egypt, Greece, and Israel. Later, when the fellows visited Florida to watch a rocket launch, MacArthur arranged a stop in Okeechobee. When their plane landed in Okeechobee, the White House fellows found a red carpet waiting for them on the runway, with the Okeechobee High School band performing for the guests as they exited the plane. Although he didn't own the town, fellows from the class of 1969 would report that it seemed like he did. With acres and acres of pasture, and cows as far as the eyes could see, it felt like a company town. Charles MacArthur's own personal county. After the White House Fellowship ended, and the MacArthurs returned to Okeechobee, Charles knew he'd be back in Washington one day, when he ran for and was elected President of the United States. But now, only 3 years after that moment, Charles MacArthur was dead. On June 13th, 1973, over 700 people were in attendance at MacArthur's funeral at the First Baptist Church. Reports of Charles MacArthur's death slowly make their way into newspapers through the local community and across the nation. As the days turn into weeks, law enforcement say the shooting is under investigation and that it wasn't a robbery and it wasn't a suicide. Behind the scenes, law enforcement keeps investigating the case. And they notice something strange. Nadine, Charles's wife, originally said on the 911 call that she was in another room when she heard a gunshot in their bedroom. But when she spoke to detectives later that morning, her story changed. Investigators from the Okeechobee County Sheriff's Office arrived to the MacArthur household on the morning of June 10th, shortly after Charles died, to determine exactly what happened. Nadine MacArthur was read her Miranda rights and asked about what happened leading up to the shooting. According to the police report, Nadine said that when the couple woke up that morning, Charles had asked her if she knew how to load the gun he had purchased a few years prior. Nadine said that Charles had bought the gun because he was paranoid that someone would try to break into their house while he was gone to kidnap the couple's 5-year-old daughter. Nadine tells officers she went to go retrieve the gun, which was located in a closet, bringing it back to the bed where she sat down next to Charles. He asked her if she remembered how to load it. She tells investigators that as she attempted to load it, she fumbled with the gun. Then, when Charles became frustrated, he reached out to grab it from her, and it went off. In incident reports written by responding deputies that morning, it's noted that Nadine wasn't emotional or upset. One report describes Nadine as being very composed, noting that she showed no signs of being emotionally upset. And Nadine's story was also slightly different when she talked to another deputy that morning. Deputy John Rux writes in his report that when he asked Nadine what happened, she replied that she had dropped the gun when sitting on the bed, and it had hit her knee and went off. So altogether now, we have three different versions of events of that morning. One, that Charles was alone in the bedroom when the gun went off. Two, that Charles grabbed the gun from Nadine when she was taking too long to load it. And three, that the gun dropped when Nadine was handing it to Charles. It's strange, right? Why are there three completely different accounts about what happened that morning, with one version where Nadine wasn't even in the room? Investigators reached out to family and friends of the MacArthurs to gather more information. One thing they're interested in is the story Nadine told about the gun. How Charles had requested she buy it because he was paranoid that someone would break in and kidnap their adopted daughter. You see, Charles had made no attempt to hide his wealth in Okeechobee. He once seriously considered buying a stake in the Miami Dolphins just so his workers could brag about it to other people in town. Compared to your average Okeechobee resident, he stood out. You wouldn't find him hunting or fishing on the weekends. You'd probably find him reading a book about management or playing tennis on the private court he had built next to his house. Perhaps he was keenly aware of how much he stood out, and that fueled his paranoia about someone breaking in while he was gone. Rumors spread throughout Okeechobee about what happened. Rumors that MacArthur actually died on June 9th, not June 10th. That he was killed in his living room, not the bedroom. Okeechobee County Sheriff John Collier releases a statement through the local paper discounting those rumors. But in some ways, you could understand why there were so many rumors. The sheriff's office was publicly saying this wasn't a break-in, this wasn't a robbery, and this wasn't a suicide. To the public, it sounds like Nadine killed Charles. And if that's the case, why were they not arresting her? Was it really all an accident? Did Nadine have any motive to want Charles dead? The rumor mill in Okeechobee went into overdrive after the shooting. Scandalous rumors about spouse swapping and Nadine having an affair. Is that what Charles was reaching out to a private detective about? To get proof of Nadine cheating on him? If you only listened to the rumors flying around town, you'd be convinced that Nadine had killed Charles to take over his multi-million-dollar estate and run off with another man. But law enforcement and the courts don't work on rumors. So investigators look into the marriage for any faults or motive for the murder. And they learn some interesting details about the married life of Charles and Nadine. Detectives learn that despite the public image of a happy marriage, there were signs of strain behind closed doors. One night, Charles and Nadine took another couple to the upscale Everglades Club in Palm Beach. This couple got a rare glimpse of a side of Charles and Nadine's relationship that not many saw. Charles, frustrated by something Nadine had said, berated and cursed at her, calling her completely stupid. Their friends sat in the back seat in silence, shocked at the outburst. Charles was very meticulous in his business dealings, but that need for order and perfection also extended to his marriage. He had a daily schedule for himself, as well as Nadine, that was broken down into 15-minute segments. And he expected her to stick to it. He was a sore loser and highly competitive. Again, a good trait to have as a businessman, but that could make relationships difficult. Nadine told a story of how she managed to beat Charles in mini golf one time, and that he reacted by grabbing the scorecard from her and ripping it up. In the months after Charles' death, Nadine is named the president and chairman of MacArthur Dairies Incorporated. She received a salary for the position, and she also inherited Charles' $34 million estate. For investigators, everything began to add up. The rumors of affairs, the strained marriage, and, most of all, the three conflicting stories Nadine gave to first responders. It all painted a picture of Charles' death not just being an unlucky accident, but a deliberate, intentional, cold-blooded murder. In August of 1973, 2 months after Charles MacArthur was shot dead, his wife, Nadine MacArthur, was charged with his murder. An Okeechobee grand jury had indicted her on a first-degree murder charge. She entered a plea of innocent, and her lawyers argued for her to be released on bond until the trial, with the judge agreeing to release her on a $50,000 bond. But did law enforcement and state prosecutors really have enough to convict her at trial? I mean, how could Charles's money be a motivation to kill him? Nadine was already married to him. It was essentially her money as well. Were the stories of problems in the relationship enough for her to murder him? You could argue every relationship has struggles and no one is perfect. Were the rumors of her affairs enough to convict her? Investigators had no hard facts of those affairs to present at trial. And that eventual trial would take some time to actually begin. It wasn't until 2 years later, in April of 1975, that the jury selection began for the murder trial. Over 40 prospective jurors were called to the courthouse, with the defense and prosecution settling on 12, 7 women and 5 men. It was the biggest trial in Okeechobee history. Maintenance workers had spent weeks upgrading the old courtroom to handle all the new spectators and reporters. Papers from halfway across the globe carried stories of the MacArthur murder trial in Okeechobee. The pulp crime magazine Inside Detective wrote stories inspired by the case, featuring a femme fatale wife murdering her rich husband in cold blood. Even with all the attention and anticipation ahead of the trial, no one could have predicted the entrance Nadine would make on that first day. And the person by her side as she arrived at the courthouse would leave the entire town in shock.
From CBS News headquarters in Washington,
President Nixon reportedly will announce his resignation tonight.
Photographers outside the Okeechobee County Courthouse had cameras ready as Nadine MacArthur arrived for the start of her first-degree murder trial. Surrounding Nadine as she walked towards the courthouse were her lawyers, as well as someone new. Guiding Nadine through the throngs of spectators and reporters was a man named Pete Huff. Huff's stocky frame towered over Nadine as they headed into the courthouse. Huff had once been a truck driver in Okeechobee, but was hired by Charles MacArthur to manage his Oak Lake apartments. Now, 2 years after his former boss Charles had died, Pete Huff was escorting his widow into the courthouse for her trial for his murder. And he wasn't there as just a family friend or an employee. He was Nadine's new husband. 4 months before the trial began, Pete Huff and Nadine MacArthur married, with Nadine taking Pete's last name. Nadine's lawyers had advised her not to marry Pete before the trial, but she did. So, does this confirm the rumors of affairs and cheating that had been swirling around town after Charles' death? Well, not exactly. According to Nadine, she had known Pete through his work for Charles. A few months after Charles' death, Nadine says she reached out to Pete for help fixing the garbage disposal at her home. When Pete came over, the two began talking and shared a few drinks. She says he never got around to fixing the garbage disposal that night, but that he would often come by and give an update on how the apartments were doing, and that she trusted him. She described him as someone who always had the right thing to say. Nadine says she was never good at managing money or being independent, and when Pete proposed marriage, she felt the offer was inviting. For Pete Huff, in the stroke of a pen, he went from an apartment manager to a millionaire. But even though she had an explanation, it still looks really bad. The optics of having a new husband shortly after your husband died are not great, especially when you're about to go on trial for your first husband's murder. The prosecution had a tough case to make for the jury. They had no confession, only a few conflicting statements. No one saw Nadine MacArthur walk into her bedroom and kill her husband. How did she do it? They couldn't say for sure. As for motive, the state attorney, Robert Stone, claimed it was for money. Stone said that Nadine wanted to own the multi-million dollar MacArthur estate. It was an extremely circumstantial case. And in a big blow for the prosecution, the testimony of Don Ross, the private detective who Charles had reached out to and told that he was in fear of his life, could not be heard by the jury, with the judge calling the testimony hearsay, since the two men had never met in person. On the defense, Nadine hired a powerful legal team worth $500,000 to prove her innocence. Leading the defense for Nadine was Eugene Spellman, a former assistant state attorney out of Dade County. The prosecution opened the trial with multiple witnesses who were the first to speak to Nadine after she reported the shooting, including the 911 operator and multiple first responders. The operator testified that she received a call from Nadine stating that, quote, "My husband went into the bedroom and I heard a shot." Then, the prosecution presented the jury the testimony of the deputies who arrived to the MacArthur house that morning, with deputies getting conflicting statements from Nadine about dropping the gun before it went off, to Charles grabbing it, which caused it to accidentally fire. And all the witnesses tell the same story about Nadine's demeanor and the time after her husband was shot dead. They say she was completely calm. The defense argued that Nadine wasn't calm, she was in shock. She wasn't even understanding the fact that she was being considered a suspect at the time. She was just in shock and trying to stay composed for the sake of their adopted daughter. Prosecutors called on the clerk who had sold Nadine the gun that killed Charles. The clerk testified that Nadine had came to the store back in 1971, 2 years before the shooting, and bought a .38 caliber gun, telling her that Charles had asked her to buy it. The prosecution was attempting to portray Nadine as the one who wanted the gun, with Charles knowing nothing about it. They called a friend of Charles who testified that MacArthur wasn't very knowledgeable about guns, and the only one he did have, a shotgun, he had given away years ago. But on cross-examination of the store clerk by the defense, the clerk admitted that she did have a memory of speaking to Charles at a later time about the gun. That statement completely contradicted the state's claim that Charles didn't know anything about the gun. The state also presented technical testimony about the gun from FDLE investigator Don Champagne. Champagne told the jury that this particular model of gun has a mechanism which prevents it from being accidentally fired when dropped. However, on cross-examination, the defense got Champagne to admit that this specific gun had a defect in that very mechanism, and that the gun did misfire accidentally when it was dropped during testing. The prosecution responded by pointing out that if the gun had gone off because Charles had grabbed it, then he would have gunpowder residue on his hands. But once again, the defense team was able to counter the state attorneys. Nadine's lawyer, Spellman, brought forth William Kennard, a forensic chemist with the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Spellman sent swabs of Charles MacArthur's hands to test, and Kennard testified to the jury that he did, in fact, find gunpowder residue on MacArthur's hands. One of the final witnesses for the defense was a highly respected medical examiner from Dade County named Dr. Joseph Davis. Davis said during questioning that after examining the photographs and witness statements, that Charles MacArthur's death was consistent with an accident. Nadine chose not to take the stand in her defense, and so she was never able to explain to the jury why there were so many inconsistencies in her first recounts of Charles dying. She had sat through much of the trial, quiet, and showing no emotion or reaction to testimony, with one exception. During testimony from a witness describing the pool of blood found on the bed under Charles's dead body, Nadine became ill and had to be helped out of the courtroom by her lawyers. After 6 days of testimony and cross-examination, it was now up to the jury. The jury deliberated for nearly 10 hours. Finally, when they notified the court they had come to a decision, the crowd of spectators and reporters returned to the packed Okeechobee County Courthouse. Nadine said quietly as the jury foreman stood up to read her verdict. They found her guilty of the first-degree murder of her husband, Charles MacArthur. Reporters and onlookers say she had no reaction, just sat silently and listened. Nadine's hearing was set for the following week, where she would learn her sentence, if she would spend the rest of her life in prison or get the death penalty. As she awaited to hear her fate, Nadine finally decided to break her silence and speak to reporters about her husband's death. At the end of a circular driveway lined with tall oak trees stood the MacArthur residence. Eight white colonial pillars lined the front porch of the six-bedroom house. In the living room, gold-trimmed Japanese urns flanked the fireplace. Down the hall sits a music room and a hideaway bar with Charles MacArthur's initials on it. The house was in the process of being sold to help Nadine pay for her mounting legal fees. Reporters tell her that people have been commenting on how calm and emotionless she was throughout the whole trial. She responds by asking, "How did they expect me to act under the circumstances? If I smiled, it would have been bad. If I squirmed, it would mean I was nervous, and then that would mean I was guilty." She says she was crushed when she heard the verdict, that she knew she was innocent. Her attorneys say it was impossible for her to get a fair trial in Okeechobee. Charles MacArthur's fame and wealth, along with the rumor mill of Okeechobee, meant that no jury was going to come into the trial with an open mind. Nadine's lawyer, Eugene Spellman, says it seemed like the Okeechobee jurors expected the defense to prove her innocent, rather than the state to prove her guilty. A few days later, Nadine was back in court. She was calm and quiet as she approached the bench to hear her sentence from Judge James Alderman. With her attorneys by her side, she listened as Judge Alderman announced that she would be sentenced to life in prison, with a minimum of 25 years to be served before she would be eligible for parole. As she returned to the defense table, onlookers said she had tears in her eyes. Her attorneys immediately filed for appeal and also argued that Nadine should be granted an appeal bond, which would allow her to remain out of prison until the appeal was granted. Judge Alderman agreed to the appeal bond over the emphatic objections of State Attorney Robert Stone. Stone argued that Nadine should begin serving her sentence immediately. The judge granted Nadine a $100,000 appeal bond. She was taken to the county jail by Sheriff John Collier, where she sat for half an hour before the appeal bond paperwork was arranged and she was let go. After the MacArthur House in Okeechobee was sold, Nadine, her daughter, and her new husband, Pete Huff, moved to Stewart to wait for the appeals process to play out. That process would take over 2 years and work its way up to the state Supreme Court. And it's there that the case would take a final and dramatic turn. Nadine's appeal was granted a hearing by the Florida Supreme Court in 1977. Her lawyers argued before the court that there was insufficient evidence for the jury to have convicted Nadine of anything. Nadine's attorney, Chester Bedell, told the court that her trial was not only flawed, but was a gross miscarriage of justice. Not only was there no evidence, he said, but the trial should have been moved from Okeechobee, where a public inflamed by rumors and gossip made it impossible for a jury to be impartial. The only reason she was convicted, he argued, was a local hostility in Okeechobee due to her wealth, hasty remarriage, and a perceived lack of remorse from Nadine by deputies who spoke to her after the shooting. In October of 1977, after reviewing all the evidence in the case, the Supreme Court, in a 4-2 vote, agreed with the defense and overturned Nadine's conviction, ruling that the state simply did not carry the burden of proof, adding that, from the totality of evidence, they were forced to conclude that the prosecution's proof of Mr. MacArthur's intentional murder was not inconsistent with the accidental death that Nadine had said happened. State Attorney Robert Stone reacted to the Supreme Court overturning his case by calling the ruling a ridiculous decision and a travesty of justice. 4 years after she was found guilty, all charges against Nadine MacArthur were dismissed. After all this time, she was free, and she was also rich. Nadine received control of the MacArthur estate. She was also able to sell off many of the MacArthur dairy assets as the years went by. Red Larson, president of Larson Dairies, entered into an agreement to buy 7,000 cattle and lease 8,000 acres from MacArthur Dairies in 1982. In a strange coincidence, when he was a teenager, Larson had actually worked for Charles MacArthur's father. Larson reported to the Okeechobee News that the MacArthur dairy operation had shrunken greatly in the years after Charles died, saying that it was only half of what it was 5 years before. He added that he thought the dairy would be thriving if Charles was still alive. Although she was finally free of the murder conviction, trouble seemed to follow Nadine over the years. In 1984, she filed for divorce from Pete Huff. 10 years of stress from the trial to a now public and messy divorce had turned her dark hair gray. And much of the fortune that was left to her was now spent or caught up in a legal battle with her ex-husband, Pete Huff. In 1984, a reporter from the Palm Beach Post caught up with Nadine, who was now living in North Carolina. At the time, she was still in the early stages of filing for divorce against Pete Huff. In her divorce complaint, she revealed that she believed Huff's intention from the very start of the marriage was to help himself to her money. She describes him as a golden-tongued talker who could sell ice to a penguin. After her conviction was dismissed, the couple built a million-dollar mansion in Stewart. As part of the settlement, she also received property in North Carolina that Charles MacArthur had owned. Charles had plans to eventually build condominiums and homes on the property. But Pete Huff had a different idea for the land. He wanted to build a farm to breed rare, expensive Peruvian horses. The couple built a small one-bedroom home on the edge of the property to stay at during the summer. But as Pete's horse farm demanded more time and more money, eventually they were living in North Carolina full-time. Even with the skyrocketing construction cost, Pete built 4 barns, a workshop, and 3 additional homes on the property. He bought 52 horses and hired 15 employees to run his horse farm. But 3 years after all that investment, only 6 horses remained. And the walls of the $300,000 barn were cracking from the mountain landslides underneath it. The last employee at the farm was quoted as saying the property was useless as a horse farm. He said, quote, "There is no flat grazing land to speak of on this mountain, and there's no places for horses to run." He theorized that Huff wanted to build a horse farm as a way to compete with Charles MacArthur, to kind of emulate the way he built up his dairy business in Florida. But, he said, there was no planning for anything. It was all just haphazardly thrown together. Nadine says she was told by Pete that they had enough money to build a farm and to not worry about it. So she didn't worry about it until she was notified by her accountant that she was dipping into the last $1 million. When Nadine started questioning Pete about the finances of the horse farm, she says the marriage turned south. One day, as the couple argued, Pete yelled at Nadine and told her that if she wanted to get rid of him, it would cost her $1 million and the horse farm. A few weeks later, Nadine served him divorce papers. Without him knowing, she had canceled their joint bank accounts, took vehicles out of his name, and took all the credit cards out of his wallet. After he was served divorce papers, he moved away from his dream project, that horse farm in the mountains, back to the couple's mansion in Stewart. In 1984, a reporter visited Huff at the Stewart mansion. As they walked through the large, empty rooms of the mansion, Huff explained that he was broke, and he said he planned to sue Nadine for alimony. But what complicated things for Pete was that Nadine had asked him to sign a prenup before their marriage. He later called her cold and calculated for doing that. He then added that towards the end, he was in fear of his life with her. In 1986, the divorce was finalized, and instead of millions of dollars, Pete Huff received $75,000. Nadine went back to using MacArthur as her last name after the divorce. She stayed in North Carolina, leaving Okeechobee and Florida behind forever. In her later years, she became dedicated to rescuing and sheltering animals. This case is strange because I can see both sides. I can see why there was so much suspicion over Nadine after Charles died. From her calm demeanor to her conflicting stories to first responders, and the marriage to Pete Huff before the trial in the midst of all the rumors of affairs and cheating. But ultimately, after reading the trial coverage, the state just did not do enough to convince me of her guilt. You can't convict someone of murder just because they aren't acting how you would want someone who lost a spouse to react. And the prosecution never had a clear explanation on what happened that fit the evidence on scene. And I really started to question how much of the narrative that Nadine never showed any emotion over Charles dying was true. I read this over and over again in police reports, news clippings, on and on, how she never shed a tear for Charles after he died. But while I was looking in newspaper archives from back in 1973, I came across something that stopped me in my tracks. There, on the front page of the Fort Pierce Tribune, was a picture of Nadine at her husband's funeral. Surrounded by Charles's friends, George Goodbread and Robert Matthews, there stood Nadine, crying, completely distraught. Nadine MacArthur passed away in 2022. Her obituary states that Nadine had devoted her life to supporting and helping animals of all sorts. After she passed, her family asked for donations to be made to a local animal rescue in North Carolina in her name. One of MacArthur's friends, George Goodbread, was quoted as saying that when Charles died, it set Okeechobee back 15 years. Now, over 50 years later, Charles MacArthur's legacy in Okeechobee is largely invisible. There are no streets named after him. No parks bear the name Charles MacArthur. For decades after his death, his charity, the Charles MacArthur Foundation, continued to give out scholarships and grants to local students from Okeechobee High School. But eventually, those donations began to slow and ultimately stop. Charles MacArthur planned to eventually leave Okeechobee. He had plans to run for governor of Florida, move to Tallahassee, and then run for president of the United States and take his family to Washington. This small town in Florida was just a stepping stone on his path to achieve something great. Instead, he would never get the chance to leave Okeechobee. his final resting place in the Evergreen Cemetery in the county is not fancy. It doesn't stand out. An understated plaque bears his name and the dates he was born and died. For a long time, Charles MacArthur was the most powerful man in Okeechobee. But now, the only thing that bears his name is a nondescript, plain grave marker in a cemetery on the edge of town. This podcast was created with research from news stories covering the life and death of Charles MacArthur and the trial of Nadine MacArthur. Stories written by reporters at Okeechobee News, the Palm Beach Post, Miami Herald, and St. Petersburg Times were used as research.
I'm moving to the rhythm of a brand new day, 'cause the vitamins and milk help me on my way.
Kick! So get on a health kick, let it pour, America's favorite.